Hi, I'm Nino Ricci, the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity at Western University, and this is Who Do You Think You Are? Each episode, we talk to someone from the Western community who is making a difference in their field by challenging old assumptions or forging new models for how we make sense of the world. These are people who are showing us that creativity lies at the heart of innovation in any field, whether it be business or law or history or the sciences or the arts. They're also showing us how creative solutions often come from building bridges across the disciplines and breaking down the barriers that often blind us to new approaches. I'm thrilled to welcome Elizabeth Green from Classical Studies here at Western to Who Do You Think You Are? She's an archaeologist who has done extensive work at a Roman site in northern England called Vindolanda, and who runs a field school there every summer for Western students. She's also been making waves recently through some of her discoveries about the role that women and families may have played in the Roman military and countering the long-held view of Roman military camps as strictly masculine bastions. When we were talking earlier, I mentioned that if I hadn't become a writer, I could easily have seen myself as an archaeologist, and you pointed out that most people respond that way when you tell them you're an archaeologist. But in your own case, you came to it somewhat late in life and kind of through a back door. Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. It is true. A lot of people that are archaeologists say, oh, I've always wanted to be, ever since I was five and digging in the sandbox. But no, that wasn't the case for me at all. I didn't really think of it. In fact, I've got this great story in, you know, high school when they said, the counselor said, you know, think about something you want to do. And they were going to put it in this new computer thing in the 1980s, and it was going to pop out, you know, where you should go to school and what you should do. And I said, archaeologist. And they said, no, no, a real job. And I think it's so funny that all these years later, that's actually what I'm doing. Because I didn't think about it until I was in my 20s. But I was doing classics, and I was learning about the Greeks and Romans, and this fascinated me. I don't know why, to be honest, for no reason, but it was the only thing in university that I just was absolutely fascinated by, and so I continued with it. And then only later, when I realized that you could dig this stuff up, that you could actually kind of be there for the investigation. And I was still in that role, that passive role of just getting the information and not asking where the information came from. And then all of a sudden, I realized that I could be a part of actually finding the information, analyzing it, creating the story. And that's when I came to archaeology.
So why hadn't that occurred to you before? And what was it that finally kind of brought it home to you?
I think it was because I was just I was a passive learner. I was just taking it all in. And I loved it. And I was engaged in that process of learning. But I was very happy to take knowledge in that and not say, well, how do we know that? Where did it come from? What's our evidence? And then when I realized that, I guess there's just this moment when you're a learner, when you realize there's actually evidence and there are different ways to interpret the evidence. So maybe it was when somebody gave me an article that had an argument rather than just a textbook, you know. So I started to kind of be more of an active learner. And then I realized, oh, this is quite cool. But also I was sort of just doing what was fun at the moment for my entire life. And so then what was fun for the moment in my mid-20s was, hey, let's go to grad school and do this in archaeology and, you know, take that classics background and pour it into actually classical archaeology, which is similar yet a sort of offshoot of classics.
So what was that transition like? Like, did it give you a different perspective on antiquity?
Number one, when you're a Roman archaeologist, you have to go to Europe to do it. So number one, someone says, well, you just simply can't stay in North America. And you think, okay. So when you are in your 20s and you want to do some traveling, it's really nice to be able to incorporate all of those things. So the transition, it's not difficult because you need to have a classics background to be a classical archaeology. And when I'm a classical archaeologist, and what I mean by that is that you need to know Greek and Latin and ancient history and art history. And then when you start applying all of those things also to the material culture of the Romans or the Greeks, we kind of do both in classical archaeology, then you call yourself a classical archaeologist rather than, say, a classicist or just a philologist or, you know, there are all different ways that classicists consider their focus. It's kind of hard to explain, but we're all classicists, but we look at different, we prioritize different kinds of evidence, whether it's literature, text, inscriptions, material culture, buildings, small finds, artifacts. You know.
So what's your focus?
My focus is digging, is actually excavating, and small finds. But I also look at texts, and I also look at inscriptions. And my questions that I ask for my research are very historical. My questions are sort of about the social history of people that were involved with the Roman army almost 2,000 years ago. I focus in on the Roman provinces. I look at Roman Britain, Roman Germany, and that is to say sort of the period of history in England that the Romans were in charge. We're sort of sometimes changing that around. Rather than sort of prioritizing Roman Britain, we say that, you know, we're looking at this particular time period.
I imagine that the questions that we ask about the past kind of change over time.
Yes.
Talk about that a bit. I mean,
yes, definitely. They do change over time. I mean, we can throw out those big things right now, like if we're in a post-colonial phase, right, where we think that we can talk about colonialism in whatever period. The Romans were certainly something that we could categorize as colonialists. They were conquering peoples that were close to them geographically. They were certainly controlling them politically, socially, but we can always ask these questions about, you know, how much of our own world are we in fact kind of imposing upon how we understand the past, right? And so our questions, depending on what world we're living in right now, certainly our questions change, or the questions stay the same, but the answers look very different in how we're. So, for instance, in Roman provincial archaeology, we're very interested now in what was the experience of the conquered. You know, this has been a couple of decades now of we're not just interested in the sort of, you know, that top end history, right? Mm-hmm. We're not just looking at the Romans came here and they conquered this. And so that the classic book about this for what we would call traditionally Roman Britain is this book from the early 20th century. It's called The Romanization of Roman Britain. And you can imagine right there what the problem is, right? This is very much, first of all, if it's a Roman Britain already, it does not need to be Romanized. But the thought that the prioritization of Roman, it takes out anything, any hope of some sort of culture remaining. But now, of course, we flip that on its head and we think, okay, well, let's look at the actual effect of all of this and what is actually happening to the people and the communities that are conquered, that are then under kind of Roman hegemony, but clearly have their own, you know, identity still. They don't just become Roman. It's not a good way of thinking about it. But in fact, it's only been, you know, a couple decades now, 20, 30 years, let's say, since people really kind of flipped that and said, okay, let's look at things differently.
So does that end up overthrowing our previous ideas of the past, or does it just add a new layer to our understanding? How does that
shift? I think the best way to look at it is that it adds a new layer. For instance, in a graduate class that I would teach on Romanization and imperialism, we actually start with some of the classic viewpoints, and they come to it without terribly much background on it. You know, they've got your basic undergraduate degree in classics or ancient history. But I actually start with some of those very old viewpoints as though, so it's almost as though we're sitting here in, let's say, 1970, and we're looking at Francis Haverfield and Tenney Frank and all of these big, they were all men at that time period, these big voices in the field. And that, I say 1970, because that's right when we start with kind of another wave of how are we viewing Roman imperialism. And it's very often affected by World War I, World War II. And in 1970, we kind of went into this new phase of how are we viewing Roman imperialism. And so all with my students, I will kind of pick apart each time period. Okay, what do we think about the people who were writing in the early 20th century? And then how about these new voices? And we'll actually act as though those are new voices to us. But then, of course, here we sit in 2019. And we have another set of voices and criticisms of what came before. But of course, what I always try to get the students to remember is that we will be sitting in that position in 30, 40 years, and them, you know, more so than I'll be hopefully retired.
Now, you recently, I think, made some waves when you discovered on Trajan's column, so this column that's been there for 2,000 years, some figures of women who had never been noticed before.
Well, it was such a weird thing. Yeah, I don't want to say that they'd never been noticed before, because this column has been picked apart. Mm-hmm. But I was, okay, so there's a place in Rome called Aeur, E-E-U-R. It's the, yes, right, you know it, you're a good Italian. They have all casts of, it's a very, very kind of fascist part of the city, right? And there's this big, huge building that we could pick apart in terms of thinking about how fascism used the Roman Empire and Roman symbolism to get their point across, but that's probably for another day. But this huge fascist building, and it's full of casts of Roman sculpture of all sorts and Roman, other kind of Roman finds, a big Roman marble Roman map of the city, all of this. And the nice thing is they do have casts, one-to-one casts of Trajan's Column, this monument that thousands and millions of people have walked past. But the problem is it actually is a column standing there, and it's 125 feet high. And so you can't really see this fully carved narrative that's on the column. So this museum brings it right down in front of your face. So I'm just wandering around, and I'm taking pictures, in fact, for teaching. I just thought, oh, this would be great. I'm gonna, you always teach Trajan's Column, and I want to show some really close-up, cool pictures of the column. And as I'm doing this, I suddenly look, and this female figure just sort of jumps out at me. I said, well, I've never noticed that before. And I thought it was just me. Well, surely I'm not the one noticing this. And so I start, you know, I went, ran back to my hotel room. I got super excited. And of course, it was closing in 45 minutes. And so I had to photograph the entire thing. I mean, there's hundreds of panels on this monument. And I had to photograph the entire thing. And I found 6 images of what could be women or girls. A couple of them are debatable. I'm actually writing this up right now for publication, hopefully. And it's really interesting because I ran back to the hotel room and started looking all over the databases for a journal article on this. These people must have been noticed. And I realized that, no, they really hadn't been discussed at all. So again, this is one of those interesting things where what modern researchers decide to focus on is what the rest of us focus on. So because people had said, well, okay, Trajan's Column is useful for, you know, X, Y, Z. It's useful for understanding military equipment. It's useful for understanding the Dacian Wars with Rome. That's the subject matter of the column. Nobody had said, is it going to be useful for understanding this other thing? And therefore, it was just pretty much overlooked. Mm-hmm. So surely somebody else had seen these before. And in fact, when those figures are discussed in other volumes, one of the problems is they are identified as boys. And I am trying to actually re-identify them. I'm trying to sort of, you know, give them a little gender re-identification.
So they would be identified as boys just to efface the problem of having a woman?
Exactly. So for such a long time, nobody thought that there were women associated at all with the military, and certainly not off on campaign. So here they are, the column, what it narrates is the wars with Dacia, which is now Romania, between the Romans conquering Dacia. And there are 2 campaigns under the Emperor Trajan, and that's what is narrated from top to bottom in this extensive frieze. And I think that part of it is that historically we've never thought about women associated with this kind of activity. This was a masculine activity. It was the soldiers who went to war. And surely the women are not fighting, but it doesn't mean that they're not there. And so that's something that's been changing over the last couple of decades that my research has been a part of, is that these individuals were very much a part of what was happening in some way or another, and not always in the same way. We don't have to, you know, imagine that women, you know, one of the problems is monolithic categories, right? We don't need to think that women were always doing the same thing in the same way associated with the military. This is always going to change. But on the column, they seem to be taking on a religious role. Because of this religious role, and because they hadn't really been considered part of any kind of military action before, I think that that's why they were just sort of said, okay, boys usually have that role, that religious role. Women do have that role. It's a kind of helping role called a camelus or a camela, depending if you're a boy or girl. And that's how I think it was originally identified in that way. And I sort of came along and said, but wait a minute, if we have women associated with the military, as several of us researchers have been saying since about the early 90s, then we don't have a problem with these individuals being girls. And so now I'm trying to re-identify and working with a good friend of mine who is Elizabeth Wolfram Thill, who works also on Roman sculpture. And we've sort of kind of come together to tackle this.
So this ties into work you've been doing at Vindolanda then as well, in terms of
yes,
the presence of women.
Yes, exactly. Which is also kind of cool to think about the fact that when I sit all the way out there on the very northwest corner of the Roman Empire. It's on the northern frontier. We're about a mile south of Hadrian's Wall. We're on the original frontier in the in Britain. That what I'm doing out there absolutely ties in to what we're finding in the very capital of the Roman Empire, in the very center, that you can use different kinds of evidence. You can use archaeological artifacts from northern England, and you can tie this story together with a major imperial public monument in the center, in the capital of this huge empire.
So, I mean, this is clear evidence of, you know, you ask a different question and you start seeing a whole different layer of reality.
Yes, yes. And in fact, that's a great way to put it, because one of the very first researchers to do this, somebody that I just owe so much to, her name's Carol Vandrill Murray, she was one of the first people to say, well, hang on a minute. We do have evidence that there are women, there are children, and that they might even be living inside of the barracks. And this is actually at Vindolanda, pretty much when I was still in high school. But I have, you know, since, once I came kind of into this research as well, we've had a lot of really fruitful discussions. But she says that she was able to think about it in a different way because she moved from England to the Netherlands. And the Dutch army just dealt with kind of social issues with the soldiers in a different way. And so she was able to just that shift in cultural perspective to say, well, we don't need to see it in this way, for instance, that women were absolutely not associated with militaries at all. And because that's actually only been true in really the very modern period, in sort of the last couple hundred years. Even sort of early modern armies always had women associated that were doing, not they weren't fighting, again, that's not what anyone's arguing for Rome either, but that they were integral parts of the sort of whole social and economic network, because they're doing jobs like laundering clothing, they're providing support to soldiers, they are, some people would, I mean, be doing things like, you know, fixing armor or more to the point, like shoes or clothing or, you know, things like this. Not that they're out there, they're not welding or anything like that. But these are integral roles for any military to have that support team in the background. And that was very often played by women. So to totally ignore that as a possibility for the Roman military, bad idea. So it's actually a good thing to think about them being there and think about what kind of support they are actually providing to an army.
In a way, it's kind of mind-boggling that we're still discovering such basic new facts from sites that have been around for 2,000 years. Maybe just talk to me a bit about Vindolanda and, you know, what it's actually like to be there and what's being found and what it's like to bring students there, what the experience is for them.
Well, my first thought on that is thank goodness that we're finding new things, because that puts me in a job and keeps me in a job. So, yay. But it is really fascinating. There's something about one of the most common things we hear from students who are excavating with us, from volunteers who are part of the excavation team at Vindolanda, is, you know, what's most exciting is the idea that I can hold something for the first time that hasn't been held by another human for 19, 18, 1700 years. Mm-hmm. And I get it. I'm not sure exactly. I think that everybody probably has a different reason why that is so exciting and so interesting to them, whether it's just that notion of so much time has passed since then. I don't know. There might be more to it for any individual. But to bring the students over there and to be at a place like Vindolanda is, for me, I think actually the most rewarding thing that I do professionally, to be honest. I love my research. I love, you know, all these other things. But bringing students there and seeing their excitement when they first land in England and they're doing something different and something that is really out of their comfort zone in a good way, in a way that, you know, wow, I am getting out into the world. I am seeing that there is far more than my little corner. You know, that's, I think, just absolutely amazing for any student to do. But then when they are part of a research team, when they are actually kind of hands-on, because one thing we don't do at Vindolanda is we don't just pull you out if you're finding something of note. You're right in there. Of course, there are supervisors everywhere. But the point is that you are part of that discovery. And at Vindolanda, you can discover some amazing things. And I would say every year we find something that ends up in the papers that everybody says, wow, that is so cool.
For example,
let's see. So one of the most famous things from the site are these things called the Vindolanda writing tablets. There are these little sort of postcard-sized letters that are wood tablets that have ink writing on them. And they are not entirely unique. A couple of other sites have found a few here and there, but Vindolanda has a large number of them. And they have all different handwriting. They have different, the letters have different foci. So for instance, some are very militaristic in the sense that they're official. They are strength reports saying this is how many people in the unit are ready for action right now. Some of them are more private letters between, let's say, the commanding officer of the unit. And the ones that I really use a lot in my research and just think are amazing are these letters that are between wives of commanding officers. So you can see why I think those are very interesting. But we actually have letters between the wives who are living up on this frontier. We don't know exactly how far from home because we don't know always exactly where they're coming from. We know we have a unit of Batavians, which are individual soldiers who are from what's now the Netherlands, now around the area of Amsterdam. Whether they were originally there, but they're probably far from home. And they're writing to each other and inviting each other to their birthday parties. So you've got this thing that over 1900 years and in totally different places, you think, oh, yeah, I'd invite you to my birthday party. You know, and it's saying, oh, the day would be so much better if you could be there. So these writing tablets tell us an amazing amount of information. Amazing amount. I mean, we even have one that says, I'm sending you socks and underwear.
So they end up seeming kind of like us.
Yes. I mean, really, the very first tablet that Robin Burley found, Robin Burley was the one who excavated the site for decades and decades, and he found the first tablets, and the very first tablet said, I'm sending you socks and underwear, which is just fantastic. And then more came out, and then, you know, we started to fill in the gaps on all this interesting information about how the military is supplied and all this stuff. But to answer your question, you know, what kinds of things are new and interesting? So these things are found fairly regularly, but maybe you'll have one here and a couple there during a season. But 2 years ago, we found another big kind of cache of these. We found another sort of 25 documents, of which a number are lengthy, substantial, and are going to give us some really new information. Now, I can't tell you what's in there because they're just being looked at right now. And the first publication is just about to come out, so I won't ruin that story for you. But the fact that we are still finding these documents that were voted about 10 years ago or so, or maybe longer, they were voted the top treasure in the British Museum. So most of them are located in the British Museum. We do have some back at Vindolanda now. So if you come to the Vindolanda Museum, you can actually have a look at those and see what they actually look like. You can see the ink handwriting, the actual handwriting of these people from such a long time ago. It's fantastic. So that's an interesting thing that we found recently.
I heard you found a wooden toilet seat also.
Yes, you read about the toilet seat. Everybody reads about the toilet seat. No, it is cool.
I guess it's rare to find wood because it doesn't
preserve. Yes, yes. So, right, I didn't actually explain that. The reason why, you know, these sort of millimeter thick, very fragile wooden documents are preserved is that we have something called anaerobic preservation, anaerobic soil conditions at Vindolanda. And that means there's no oxygen getting in, which means you don't have that same kind of bacteria that breaks down organic materials. So the things that we find in abundance that are not unique, other sites can be anaerobic, but kind of allow us to continue with these amazing finds, are wooden objects and leather objects. So I'll talk about the leather in a minute if you want. But the wooden objects are fascinating. And one of the things we found, yes, indeed, was a toilet seat, which was found actually chucked in, if I remember correctly, it was found right after I had left for the season, came back to teach here at Western. And I think it was chucked into a ditch. So it had probably, its use had perhaps been over, or it, you know, just kind of fell in and somebody said, oh, I'm not running after that. But it really does look like a modern toilet seat, except that it's a piece of wood that's kind of long, but the hole, it's the same as, I mean, you look at it and you go, oh, that's a toilet seat.
Yeah, I had a wooden toilet seat at one point.
Oh, so yeah,
they came back in at a certain point.
Yeah, yeah.
So you found a lot of shoes, I guess, at the site as well.
Yes. So the other thing is leather. And Vindolanda has the largest, what we call a single site assemblage of leather, meaning so other museums have lots of leather in the museum. We have a fair bit of leather from the medieval period, but from the Roman world, this is the largest assemblage of Roman leather from any one single site, and it's all located in the Vindolanda Museum. So to put that into perspective, we have about 7,000 distinct leather numbers. That means the sort of accessioning from the excavation into the museum stores, about 7,000 things that say, you know, leather item number this, and about 5,000 of those are shoes. So you might be thinking, well, what do we learn from that?
Yes.
The shoes are really fabulous. I just got a Shirk Partnership Development Grant to look into this more. So Barbara Burley, who's the curator of the Vindolanda Trust, and I have been putting together a series of grants to really look into these further, because the shoes are incredible. So the main thing I would say that I look at anyway, everybody has an angle on shoes, but I look at demography. So what I'm interested in is, who does this shoe represent? And I'm working with a researcher from Durham University, a physical anthropologist named Trudy Buck, who looks at also who wore this shoe, who does this shoe represent. I'm interested in things like the question of women and children. So, okay, does this shoe represent an individual who we have traditionally thought was on a site like this or not, right? Is this an adult male? Is this a child? Somebody like the physical anthropologist, like Trudy Buck, will be looking at that same question. She's interested as well, and she can help me out with these questions. So it's a really cool collaborative project. But she can also look at things like health and disability. Do we have something going on where the shoe can tell us that this individual had gait problems or something like that? So what kinds of health issues were coming into play? There is evidence from the shoes that the Romans, in fact, understood how to correct for individual gait. So perhaps our original podiatrist kind of thing. I'm also just now starting to work with a pedorthist who is actually here at Western, a guy called Colin Dabrowski. People may have seen the Soul Science trucks, vans that drive around campus. He's the founder of Soul Science, and he looks at things like wear patterns on shoes to understand differences in gait and corrections and things like that. So he's going to take his knowledge and apply it to an ancient body of material, so these ancient shoes. So we can learn a lot about these individuals, how they're moving, how they used this equipment, how they understood sort of medical concerns that had to do with the feet, of course, not everything. But so it kind of goes on and on. The other thing is, if you look at leather from a sort of flip that around, not so much the finished product, but we're also looking, I'm working with some chemists at Teesside University that are looking at both the soils and the leather itself to understand issues of tanning and how they were actually working leather. And this gives us a lot of information about sort of technology transfer and what's happening with, let's say, when an Iron Age population in Britain, when they come into contact with the Romans and they realize, they're doing things differently. The adoption of technology, or maybe not even adoption, maybe the Romans forcing new technology on other people. So it can also help us with this question of, you know, how does conquest affect people that I had talked about earlier? And also, just, it doesn't necessarily need to be, you could have an adoption of techniques or of products, right? And just sort of how these things are moving around, how these ideas and the materials moving around the Mediterranean through processes of conquest.
Now, presumably, 100 years ago, people didn't have access to the kind of analysis you can now do. So what difference has just the progress of science made in the questions we can ask of materials from the past?
It's amazing. It's really amazing. I mean, even in just what I think of as a short career. So I finished my PhD in 2011. I've been at Western ever since. But I've been digging at Vindolanda excavating since 2002. And in 2002, one of the first things that I was digging with, who's now actually my co-director of the field school, also in classics, Alex Meyer, he was digging next to me, and he found a human skull, and that human skull had teeth in it, Well, back in 2002, we could do a certain amount of, when I say we, I mean not me. I love archaeology for its collaborative nature. I send these things to somebody else. So the Vindolanda site has a whole array of scientists that they work with. In 2002, you could do certain things with these teeth. You could understand, you could analyze the isotopes that are found inside of the teeth. You could understand perhaps where this individual grew up based on the isotopes in the growing teeth in the kind of early years. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, DNA analysis was, the ability for DNA analysis to tell us this and that has come along so much. It's good that in 2002 we only kind of used one or two teeth for this analysis, because we still have a whole bunch of teeth in this guy's head, and we can continue year on year. These things just jump exponentially. And I'm not actually going to even try to talk details to you about this, because I don't know. This is where I send it off and I say, okay, great, this is your job. And then they give me these reports. And this is why archaeology is so great. The collaborations in archaeology and the ability to just say, okay, this is something that you're interested in that will actually further your field, whether it's isotopic analysis, whether it's DNA analysis. This will help you furthering your field, and it will, and then your results will help me furthering my field. So if they come back and say, hey, wow, you know, this individual grew up in North Africa, for instance. We do have some human skeletal remains that are from North Africa, but here we are all the way up in Northern England. So then it's my job to sort of piece together, right, how can we imagine, how do we understand, what other evidence do we have about this time period when these material remains were found, when, you know, this individual was maybe interred? What else can we say about this North African origin? So they're interested in the DNA or the isotopes or whatever it might be. I'm interested in what that kind of inserts into the story of this human being.
Uh-huh. So clearly, I mean, we've been talking in these podcasts about creativity. Clearly, there's a creative element that comes into this pretty strongly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's right. This is all about creativity, isn't it? It's funny, you picked the most sort of social science-y arts and humanities faculty member you could probably find in me.
Perfect.
Yeah. Let's say, I think I'll need to say, okay, I don't want to say there's creativity in archaeology, because I will probably get into a lot of trouble. However, it is absolutely true that the archaeologist puts as much of themselves into the analysis as anybody else. So there was this big push in the 1960s to have archaeology as a classified as a hard science, that it mm-hmm. we should always be able to replicate in other words, if you excavated a section of ditch right here, you should be able to excavate a ditch right over here without knowing anything else about that section of ditch. And it should be exactly the same as the one, 5 feet to its left, to the east or something. And that's just simply not true. There's as much analysis. Not that I'm saying that your results are necessarily entirely the person that you are and the ideas that you put into it. Obviously not. There's data and there's evidence and there are comparisons to be made and there's material that we need to take into account from previous excavations. But it's absolutely true that archaeologists disagree about the same exact evidence, and the way we analyze it can absolutely change mm-hmm. based on our own experiences.
Uh-huh. So it's a matter of who can put together the most credible story based on the data points.
Yes, yeah. There's a certain aspect. And I would say that you do have to be a bit creative, because archaeologists you get stumped. We do not know everything, mm-hmm. right? That's the beauty of it. And often people come along and they say, so the site, the Vindolanda is touristed. It's a touristic site. People come along. We have, hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. And one of the most common questions that I get is, well, what are you going to find there? And of course, the answer is, I have absolutely no idea. I can hypothesize, well, okay, we are in what should be a ditch system, because I know from 1999, the excavations over there, we had a ditch coming along here. Logic tells me that that should continue and is probably going to turn right here. So we have hypotheses based very much in what we have learned from past excavations. But it can always surprise us. Uh-huh. It can always. So uh-huh. I always tell the students every year, I say, okay, so we have our syllabus, and we literally the syllabus says every day, this is what we're going to do. But that could just change, because if we find something spectacular, A, you'll be part of this amazing discovery, so yay. But we need to be flexible, because everything, if we suddenly find a whole bunch of human burials, we need to just halt the excavation and say, okay, we need to deal with this. We need to deal with this properly. You know, so things, you never know what you're going to find
are
in archaeology.
There, so if you find human remains, are there then ethical questions that come up? Are there protocols around human remains?
Yes. One thing in England that was interesting, we found that skull that I referenced mm-hmm. a bit ago. That skull, because of its location, so one thing with human remains, you do actually have to report it to the police.
Just to say
that we found them, our analysis is that they indeed are 1900 years old, and here is the evidence for that, and you know, they weren't buried in our excavation last night. You know, there was no concrete on the feet. But it became very interesting because I remember when we did this was 2002, and the next day, I think that every local police officer came down and had to just check it out for themselves and look at, but really it was a beautiful sunny day and here we are in this gorgeous site. But everybody has an interest in the remains of the past in some way, you know. And so everybody sort of used it as a great, although the officers used it as a nice excuse to come down to the site and have a look, you know, but it was under professional reasons. But so that is one of the things. Human remains are, we don't have issues of sort of no one is there saying, hang on, this could be my uncle or my, you know, great-great-great-great-great-grandfather or great-great-great-great-grandmother. Let's use that one. But you do have, I think, certainly a responsibility when you're dealing with human remains. I think, anyway, I feel that I need to be a little bit more somber and a little bit more, you know, respectful with that.
On the other hand, you probably get great data from human remains.
Oh, great data from human remains. Yeah, great data. I mean, they can tell us so much about... I should say, though, we don't find too many because we have not excavated at Vindolanda what we think are the kind of official burial, the official burial area. That would probably be on land that is not owned by the Vindolanda Trust. Maybe not. It's just we haven't found it yet. And that's that. So that's one issue. But what we find are usually what we might classify as deviant burials. So burials that are not sort of more traditionally in the format that we would expect. But one of our interesting lines of inquiry lately is, wait, but what is a normative burial pattern? Perhaps all of these non-normative burial patterns are in fact the norm, right? That what we've been calling deviant burials are in fact just showing the variety of burial possibilities. And my example is... what I've just been writing up recently and is just, I think I'm about to get the off print any day now, is between me, Alexander Meyer, Trudy Buck, Victoria Barlow, and Eleanor Graham. We've all been doing DNA, they've been doing DNA analysis, and we've been writing up a body that we found in a ditch. And this will come out in the journal Britannia in the next few weeks for the first view. And it was a body that was found just kind of left inside of a ditch, and it didn't seem to have any formal burial. What we've been finding out about that is, A, what are the possibilities for human remains, or in terms of the, how does one treat human remains? So in this case, there didn't seem to be any formal treatment of those human remains. They just seem to have been let loose in a Roman ditch. And whatever was going to happen, happened. So one of the things we're analyzing is something called the taphonomic process. So what happens to that body after it goes into the ditch? In other words, very practically speaking, first the legs are going to come off. The arms are going to come off. The head's very heavy, so that falls in and it kind of stays put because it can sit in the sediments. How does the silt form around it? That kind of thing. That kind of data and that kind of analysis can, you know, that's of interest for, we've been looking at sort of forensics, actually. In order to look at our comparison, say, okay, well, if we were looking at this in the modern world, how can we compare what we found in this ancient context to a sort of forensic analysis of today? So that's an interesting connection there. But then just in terms of the bones, we discovered from the DNA, and this is actually a case where the DNA was not very well preserved, but in modern scientific analysis, it's so much, the DNA analysis that we can do is so much better than it was even 10 years ago. So we did get DNA, and it looks like the individual is from northern UK. This is, again, not exactly my department, but there seems to be some Italian origin on the paternal side. So Are we looking at, you know, the son of a soldier who had either rightfully or wrongfully had relations with a woman, a native British woman? Uh-huh. So we can start to talk about that through this analysis. So that's something that's interesting as well.
And you say that, you know, there may be a burial site somewhere in some farmer's field. So how much stuff could be out there? Do you have any
there
sense of how much is still waiting to be uncovered?
Yeah, we can't put a number on it, but, you know, I often do get the jokes when I say I'm an archaeologist and people say, really? Hasn't everything been dug up already? No, it really hasn't. We don't know. We don't know what's left out there, but so much is left for discovery. And I should point out too, not left for discovery, but left hopefully to be saved. I mean, so much of this stuff is just being covered over by, you know, tarmac parking lots and Tesco's and, you know, Loblaws. And we really, really do need to preserve this information and this data and these and remains wherever they are, you know, in the world.
So I'm a student from Western. I've come out to Vinalanda. What are the chances that I'm going to find something new in my summer's work?
The chances of finding something new at Vinalanda are very high. So when I was the young student and went to Vinalanda and said, you know, with this big smile on my face, well, I thought I'd come along and dig and see if I want to switch from, you know, ancient history to archaeology. And they all said, oh, Phil, fantastic, but you better go somewhere else after this. Because at Vinalanda, you do find stuff all day, every day. You find lots of material, partly because we have this anaerobic preservation that preserves just the quantity of material is greater because you've got all of the organic material that usually has disintegrated. So depending on where you are in the excavation, like in the area, what kind of preservation you have, you could find more, you could find less. But you always have pottery. The Romans left so much pottery around the world, around the Roman Empire. There's more Roman pottery than, you know, anyone should ever have to deal with in their lifetime. So you're finding pottery all the time and cool stuff, ceramics that are molded and have figures on them and painted and all sorts of interesting stuff. Roman coins, everyday artifacts like ear cleaners and brooches and, you know, metal objects, sometimes that we can't even identify. We have, you know, there are certain things that we look at and say, wow, I have no idea what that is. And you just start doing a bit of research and you find a similar thing found somewhere else and you say, aha, ooh, that's a, you know, part of a harness to a, you know, I don't know, X, Y, or Z object.
So a great site for students to get their hands dirty in.
A great site for students to get their hands dirty.
And what's it like, that thrill of?
Well, let's see. The thrill of finding something for the first time. I mean, it is, people, honestly, sometimes the students can't sleep at night on the first time that they find something significant. And the ones that I really appreciate, the things that I love are the students who, some of them can be sustained on one little shirt of pottery, one little piece of pottery, and they're so excited. Others kind of go, and they're kind of waiting for the big find, you know. But the first time you see somebody find, let's say, a shoe, if we're in that right kind of organic context, the first time they find a shoe, they are on cloud nine. I mean, it's just amazing. But the kind of the more deep question, you know, why do people want to find the remains of human life from the past? I think everyone has a different answer for that. But there is something inherently fascinating for people to hold something that has not been touched since the kind of last owner dropped it.
And just that connection to history, to deep history. I mean, I guess analogously, we look at the fire in Notre Dame and how that has really stirred people's emotions at a very deep level when we lose part of the past in that way. Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, it is really interesting. Something, of course, that just fresh happened yesterday, right? And so I think people are still feeling very emotional about that. And it is really interesting. But I think what we can learn, I mean, I did actually shed a little tear. I was like, I don't know if it was for the sort of symbolism of that. But I think what we can really learn from that and how we can tie that into what it is that I've chosen to do with my life is just that we can't forget how important history is to people. And not so much just history, but understanding that people appreciate beautiful things and the sort of longevity of beauty and understanding the history of humanity and human endeavor and human accomplishment. I think that that's what was all wrapped up in Notre Dame. And if you can hold it in that one building, or you can kind of hold that same feeling in an ancient shoe. It's kind of amazing when you think about it. You can have, I think, an analogous feeling, which is pretty amazing.
You mentioned earlier how the fascists, for instance, used Roman history in their particular way. So mm-hmm. we're always using history for our purposes in some way. Mm-hmm. There's this, I guess, bigger story that's sort of more the human one as opposed mm-hmm. to the propaganda one. How do you see the function of archaeology and the work that it does sort of within the humanities, within...
Well, I think the function of archaeology, one thing that might... It might make this real for people. It might make history real for people, because I think it's very easy for people to forget, actually, how important history and just sort of understanding and remembering, you know, human accomplishment, how important that actually is, right? Because people constantly... legislate against it. They, they take away funding to arts and humanities and things like that. But we need to be reminded of it. So archaeology, in a way, is sort of this bridge between the past and why we still should care about these things. Because if I can return to Notre Dame, it's interesting that now, I mean, we've all heard the stories now in the last 24 hours, that actually when Victor Hugo wrote Notre Dame was a pile that was falling apart. And because of the success of Hunchback, then people said, oh, well, maybe we should save this building, right? There are Notre Dames all over not only Europe but the world that are crumbling to pieces right now. So in a way, archaeology is this thing that's happening in the moment right now that is reminding people regularly that we do care about these things and we should care about these things and we should continue to put the money into whether it's kind of things need to be, whether it's conservation or whether it's just keeping the importance of human history at the forefront of people's minds. But we don't do that. We forget about things very easily, and we forget about the importance of history and beauty and creation and accomplishment. It quickly goes away from people's minds until we're forced to think about it, like mm-hmm. Notre Dame burning down.
So you could see this as a learning moment for
yeah.
us in terms of, as you say, the many other monuments out there that need attention. And
yeah,
need,
yeah, there are so many monuments that need attention.
A good sprinkler system in place.
Yeah, exactly. And we've made Notre Dame what it is. I mean, there are so many amazing, not just cathedrals, but amazing mm-hmm. structures all over the place. But mm-hmm. we've made Notre Dame the sort of symbol that it is. But there are so many other things that could be in that place as well.
And so, I often hear in Italy people talking about how the government can't afford to maintain its vast wealth of antiquities. Mm-hmm. I've often been in Italy and gone to museums where half of it is closed because they can't afford to hire guards to watch the whole thing. So how much is under threat of our...
A lot. If you go to Pompeii, you will mm-hmm. half of Pompeii will be closed. They are actually, though, in the last year, a couple of years, there have been some really great conservation efforts at a place like Pompeii. But the other thing you may have noticed in Italy, speaking of, there's a big controversy about whether or not we should be allowing corporations to be fixing these old buildings. So have you noticed, let's say, have you been to Venice recently? So much of St. Mm-hmm. Mark's Square is plastered in advertisements. But those are the companies that are actually putting money mm-hmm. into these structures. So there's a big debate about that, which I don't actually know which side I sit on, to be honest. So I don't really feel one way or the other. And it's not really my issue. But Notre Dame was crumbling last week, and the government wasn't able to really put the money into it. But this week, it's practically fallen, and it's got $300 million already chucked at it. Probably more. I mean, I think I read that this morning. So now people are vowing loads and loads of money, too, which is great, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But we do have to ask ourselves, how do we pick what it is that we think is worth the money mm-hmm. and the effort? What are our human endeavors and our human accomplishments, which ones are worth saving and protecting and which ones are we just going to let go? One of the most common questions I get on the site, in fact, is from students, from visitors to the site, is, wait, but why was this all let to crumble anyway? Why is it underground? And, you know, you have to tell people about things that are valued and things that are not valued. And why is it valuable now that it's under the ground versus, you know, nobody cared about it when it was falling to pieces?
Has there been are there pendulum swings in terms of archaeology? Clearly there was a period when nobody cared at all, where you went, you know, there was a site, you just pillaged it to build your home. So when did we start becoming interested in preserving the past and is it likely to continue into the future?
Well, I hope it continues because, then again, I'm in a job and I get to keep my job. So let's hope it continues. I think it's a valuable experience, you know, whether somebody's going to go into archaeology or not, actually taking part in something I think so important for keeping the past alive. I think that anybody can get something out of that. When did the pendulum swing? The best way for me to, in the modern world, let's say, in the very modern period. So when I started this in 2002, I couldn't say exactly when things like Time Team had actually started. You guys know Time Team. It's this British show that has become incredibly popular, and it is about archaeology. They go into a site, and they have 3 days to excavate this site, and it's all very frantic, and they're trying to figure out what's going on. And it became really a hit. I mean, everybody loves it. So when I started in 2002, I don't know if the show had started or not yet, but it wasn't popular enough at this point that nobody would come along and ask us, you know, about our methodology on the excavation or anything like this. Well, the show becomes popular at some point in the last, call it 20 years. I don't know when. And all of a sudden, we have volunteers, or rather, I mean to say, tourists who come to site, and they come to the trench edge. And they say things to us like, pardon me, have you done your ground penetrating radar on this site before you've excavated it? You know, and all of a sudden they actually know. Nobody had ever uttered the words ground penetrating radar to me in 2002. But suddenly the public is a part of the process and they want to check that we have done our GPR, which is fantastic. You know, it's really funny. And so this started happening, I would say, about 10, 12, 15 years ago, where people really were taking part in what was happening. There's also in England, there's something called the Heritage Lottery Fund where there are these grants that people can get, that sites can get. And then they're given out to all sorts of places to sort of just protect heritage, basically, and to help heritage groups, you know, for many different things, museums, places like Vindolanda, but then also to, let's say, preserve some sort of traditional crafts or something like this, right? So I think a combination of things have really kind of brought archaeology into the household in a way that it wasn't even 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, I've only been in the game 19 years myself, 18 years. So what it was before that, I couldn't quite say from the same perspective I can say now. But there definitely does seem to have been a swing more recently towards understanding archaeology and being a big part of it.
And, you know, where do you see it going? Like, what's exciting now in terms of new developments in archaeology, either in terms of what's being found or how it's being looked at or the technology that allows you to look at it?
I think it's probably technology. So one of the cool things that we're doing now that's really common is something called photogrammetry, where you can just easily and cheaply, I think is the point, whereas these sorts of things would have been just kind of out of the budget of any archaeologist, you know, a decade ago. But you can easily and cheaply render a 3D model of a building, of a stratigraphic unit, of your excavation trench, whatever it is that you're looking to render. You can do this just with the snap of the camera. Get as many angles as you can. And in fact, that brings us back to Notre Dame, because in 2015, it was laser scanned, the inside of Notre Dame. And so actually they will be able to, we have a rendering, exact rendering.
So they can recreate it.
They will be able
down to the smallest.
Yes. And that's just what I read in the paper. So hopefully that's true, because that would be really fantastic. But we do this on archaeological excavations as well. So, and a good example, one year I was excavating a kiln, a Roman kiln. And we worked through the day, and there we thought we were sort of on the face of the flue and on the face of what it looked like. And we, at the end of the day, did a 3D model of it. And then a few days later, and then we were working around it and doing various things. And couple days later, there was a giant rainstorm. Here we are in northern England, and it rained so hard that, in fact, it pulled those faces off to reveal a much nicer, not monument, but structure, let's say. It's not a structure with a roof, but it's a kiln, big kiln, like walk-in size kiln. So what I had were two phases of one single structure. And I had a 3D model of the later phase, which then, against my wishes, but that darn rainstorm, took down a whole bunch of it. But I had a 3D model of the original one, and then I could make another 3D model but also still have the structure that was later. So there's a lot of cool stuff that's going on. So I do think it's technology. It's also the ability to bring together a lot of data and search a lot of data so that you can ask questions of the material. Like I mentioned, those shoes, it's really, really hard to actually organize 7,000 pieces of leather or 5,000 shoes. But I'm actually doing that right now by putting everything into a database and really being able to cross-search it and actually ask a lot of interesting questions of this data that just wouldn't have been possible 10 or 20 years ago, or until you found the means to be able to, the means and the time, I should say, to be able to put all of this into the formats that we have now.
So this, I mean, it kind of puts you at the intersection of a lot of fields of knowledge. I mean, you've got the science, the history,
absolutely,
the social history.
Yeah.
Which part of your brain is sort of most engaged in that?
Social history. I'm the social historian. I'm the one who's coming up with the questions that say, you know, what is it about the Romans, the soldiers, the people on site, the people of the past? I want to know about their lives, about who they were and what they're doing. And I'm able to collaborate with a lot of other people who are going to help me towards understanding that. And in the meanwhile, they're going to answer questions for themselves, right? They're going to be working within their fields. But the answers that they're feeding to me are going to help me with the social history. Uh-huh. But this is what I love. I love the collaboration. I love that I am working with, I mean, when I said, okay, we got to put this all in a database, and I thought, right, I need to go to the computer science department. I need to find somebody in chemistry that I can collaborate with. So if you're listening, I need you. Come talk to me if you're interested in any of this. Because there's a lot of potential here. There's a huge amount of potential. And you get to meet all sorts of people and learn about their aspect of things and hand over chunks of your work and say, right, I need you to do this. And then we collaborate on what the analysis is.
It's interesting that we're closer now to understanding the past and giving a complete picture of it than we were in the past.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's this thing in archaeology. A lot of people say, well, we always have to preserve part of a site for the future. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think that is true. Like I said, with our skull, we're so glad that we have some of his teeth left, because if we had tried to analyze them all in 2002,
right,
we just can get so much more information off of them in 2019. The same is true of sites. People say we should preserve the sites. We shouldn't. But there are different scales of belief of this. So some people say we shouldn't excavate at all, because we should save everything for the future. But of course, there's always a future, right? There's always
start
saving for the future, yeah, right? So what a lot of people do actually is you don't just bulldoze and say, right, we're going to excavate everything in the next 2 years. You know, you preserve things and say, right, in the future, someone's going to be able to do that better and differently. But, you know, you hope that your work right now, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. So I hope that I am shoulders to be stood on, not to be stomped out in 30, 40, 50 years.
I'm sure you are. and it's been fascinating talking to you. I want to thank you for coming in today, Beth.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really great.
We've been talking to Elizabeth Green in the Department of Classical Studies at Western. I'm Nino Ricci, and this has been Who Do You Think You Are? A Western University podcast.